This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of March 19th, 2010. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. Jobs, 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 jobs. This week, Congress turned its attention to the millions of Americans holding up their own help wanted signs. It passed the first in a series of bills intended to encourage companies to do more hiring. It includes a $1,000 tax credit for some new employees, and it exempts companies from paying Social Security taxes on those new hires. Question is, can a bill like this make a dent in a nearly 10% unemployment rate? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson is in New York, and he joins us now. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Tess.
So the bill passed. Does this mean more people are going to find work?
Well, I hate to say it, but one of the guys who originally proposed a hiring tax credit says maybe 200, 250,000 people will find work. You got to remember, 8.4 million have been laid off since the recession began.
So this is the proverbial drop in the bucket.
Exactly. John Bishop is the guy who proposed a hiring tax credit. He's a professor of human resource studies at Cornell. And he says this $1,000 credit is much smaller than the one used in the late 70s to spur hiring. And it's only for people who've been laid off for at least 2 months.
It's more than just watered down. It's trying to change who is hired rather than trying to send the signal, we want your total employment to go up.
He says a larger tax credit, maybe $5,000 per new employee, would have been more appropriate. But of course, that costs more, and nobody in Congress really wants to take the position of wanting to spend more money right now, even if it means creating jobs.
Yeah. You know, there's been a lot of talk recently that this is, in fact, a jobless recovery. And it sounds like this bill isn't going to do a whole lot to help that.
Yeah, and we got another indication that it is a jobless recovery. The Brookings Institution came out with a study this week. It looked at the 100 biggest metro areas in the country and found that they're recovering at a slower rate than at the 2-year point following the last three recessions in this country. The worst hit areas in the survey, maybe not a surprise, the places that were really hit by the housing bust, Florida, Nevada, California, 99 of the 100 places in the survey have not gained back as many jobs as were lost during this recession. Any guesses on the one that has?
I probably shouldn't even try to venture. Podunk?
Nope. It's McAllen, Texas.
McAllen, Texas. Why?
Well, McAllen, Texas, and a lot of parts of Texas and Oklahoma and upstate New York are the places that are getting jobs right now. And Chris Lowe, who is the chief economist at FTN Financial here in New York, points out all of these places have one thing in common when it comes to jobs.
We're talking about agriculture and commodity production. It's not manufacturing. It's not tech. It's pulling resources out of the land, which we obviously do, but it's not where we really shine.
And he says one other thing that makes this recovery different from others is that because housing prices have fallen so much, so many people are underwater on their mortgages, even if they wanted to move, they can't. They're stuck in their homes.
Well, I know that Congress is talking about more legislation to create jobs, specifically in small business. What are the folks that you've been talking to think is the best strategy at this point?
Well, a bigger hiring tax credit, they point to the 70s. They say, look, it worked in the 70s when there was a hiring tax credit. Many people say simply the demand has to come back. They're not going to hire until they're sure that people will buy their products and that the recovery is here to stay. And as much as the stock market keeps going up, there are still a lot of jitters out there about whether we're in for a double dip recession.
Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson speaking with us from our New York bureau. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tess.
This weekend, about 100,000 activists are expected to converge on Washington, D.C. to rally for reform. Healthcare reform? No. Financial reform? No. Immigration reform. It's a pocketbook issue for many in the immigrant community. And in a sense, just getting to the demonstration presents a financial hurdle. To help foot the bill for Latinos to lobby Congress, communities have held grassroots fundraisers across the country. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler takes us to a couple of them.
We start in northern Ohio, in Ashtabula. It's a Rust Belt town of 20,000 on Lake Erie. Here, near the border with Canada, you wouldn't necessarily expect to hear this. The Hispanic community makes up about 5% of the town's population. 2 weeks ago, they held a fundraiser at a local church, but it wasn't called a fundraiser.
It's actually a Mexican word. It's kermes.
That's Veronica Dahlberg, executive director of a local nonprofit Latino organization called OLA. The goal was to raise $1,200 to pay for buses to bring people to Washington.
This is a perfect fundraising tool for our community because with the economy being so hard right now, you can't charge folks a lot of money.
Folks at this fundraiser buy tickets for about a dollar each. Then they exchange the tickets for food, tostadas de ceviche, tamales, enchiladas.
It's kind of like a spaghetti dinner, but with Mexican food.
Angel Zavala owns a Hispanic grocery store in town. He donated ingredients for the food. For him, investing in immigration reform protects his own economic interests. He says business at his store has been slow.
Last year, we lost a lot of people because immigration and police were taking too many people and sending back to Mexico.
The kermes is a lot like any conventional American fundraiser, though you hear a bit more Spanish. Kids played games for a dollar a pop, like throwing darts at balloons. Like any good civic citizens anywhere, the local Hispanic business leaders donated prizes for a raffle.
Yolanda M.
Yolanda M.
Organizers decided not to include one fundraising gimmick that had previously backfired. Veronica Dahlberg says a woman at another event was raising money by selling fake marriage certificates.
I think adults were $2 and kids were $1 to get married. And she would perform a little ceremony, and it was really cute, and the people were paying it.
A married man bought a marriage certificate, but not for his wife. She learned about the fake marriage when the DJ announced it.
And his wife said, What is this? And she went over and literally whacked him in the back of the head with her hand.
No one got whacked in the head at this event, and the kermes brought in $1,500, $300 more than their goal. Hispanic groups all over the country have been holding similar fundraisers. In Los Angeles, one organization gathered money by throwing a house party. Under disco lights in the backyard, people did a Texas-style line dance to a Spanish-language version of Achy Breaky Heart. The cover charge for the party was $5. Margaritas cost $4. The party raised a few hundred dollars for the trip to D.C. Tony Bernabe organizes day laborers for CHIRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles. He estimates that each person needed $600 to pay for the flight, hotel, and food. The organization could help, but nobody got a completely free ride.
Sometimes they are being helped with a donation or somebody's paying for them, but they have to put $100 to go.
Why require poor laborers to come up with $100? He says the money demonstrates commitment.
We have to pay for our struggle. Nothing is for free.
Bernabe won't compromise, even for his own daughter.
She's saving the allowances to pay for the $100 because she has to pay $100 like any other flying to D.C. with us.
One of those flying to D.C. is 17-year-old Anna Juarez. To raise money, she bought Mexican candies from the store and sold them at school.
For everything, it cost me like $25, and I was going to earn $46, but I stopped selling them.
She had plenty of customers, but she also had an ethical problem.
I don't eat candies, so it's like weird because I'm selling candies and I don't eat them. It's unhealthy and everything, you know, so I stop it.
She still raised enough for the trip with some left over, though she can't really expect any appreciation on $10 worth of lollipops flavored with chili. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
Time again for your comments. You may remember last week we invited you to light our inbox on fire. Well, you were most happy to oblige. We suspected that might be the case after our commentary from David Sachs.
Then there's the constant social pressure to tip more, disconnected from the quality of the service.
You tipped the scales with your own thoughts on the matter. Moira Mannion, herself a Marketplace commentator, wrote in from Minneapolis with this suggestion. If, as you, David Sachs, suggest, an employee should be penalized for spilling wine on you, which is sometimes the customer's fault, How about we charge more if the customer is rude, arrogant, crude, and treats us with less respect than a slave? Sarah Young worked at a restaurant in tiny Halfway, Oregon, near the Idaho border. She says any waitstaff worth their salt will provide good service no matter the tip.
I usually tried not to notice how much tip any table left. You see over time that the amount of money tipped has much more to do with the person leaving it than with your work.
Mr. Sachs had also wondered aloud if it would just be easier to tack a service charge onto the check. B. Smith of Jefferson City, Missouri, says if or when that happens, she'll stop eating out. Also on last week's show, Kathy Kristoff and I expressed our disagreement over a caller who wanted to help her 27-year-old son save for retirement. Kathy asked,
when are you going to let him run his life?
I countered that the world could use more Budinskys. Joshua Povich wrote in from San Francisco to say that ending up with no savings because parents are trusting one to live your own life is too tough and too common a lesson. And finally, last week, Shannon Bradford of Cincinnati, Ohio, was giving her taxes one final glance before sending them off. Our show happened to be on at the time, and she heard our segment about the Making Work Pay credit.
I made $400 listening to Marketplace Money on Saturday. I immediately went to IRS's website and grabbed that Schedule M and the instructions and revised my federal tax form.
You're welcome. We welcome your calls and scribbles. Write to us at marketplace.org. For sale signs litter neighborhoods across the country, perhaps nowhere more than here in California. So it's a buyer's market, right?
Every house we put an offer on, we were so excited, but there were so many offers.
Multiple bids are back. And we've got multiple ways for you to hear our show. Download our podcast anytime. Just go to marketplace.org. And there's more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. If the most famous cliche in real estate is location, 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 the second most famous goes something like this. There's no such thing as a national housing market. Just like politics, real estate is local. The housing bust started here in California and bulldozed its way across the country. Now, something new is happening here. And one of the nuttier elements of the real estate boom has returned.
This is our favorite part of the house, the backyard, because it has a pool.
Kelly Frombach and her husband Andy moved into their first home just a few months ago. She's a 32-year-old office manager for a construction company. He's 29 and works in tire repair.
And then this is the kitchen, and we're pulling up all the tile to put wood in. And we have quite a ways to go because it has to be sanded.
This California ranch-style home in Chino Hills, just east of Los Angeles, boasts three bedrooms and two baths, 1,200 square feet for them and their 7 and 9-year-old kids. They started going to open houses back in mid-2008, just as the market was collapsing.
I thought, oh, I'll get a house. You know, we'll be homeowners soon. I really fell in love with quite a few homes along the way, and going one, oh, I want this one, hopefully, you know, and your hopes, you get your hopes up, and then...
We'll let Kelly finish that sentence later. Meantime, here's economist Chris Thornburg.
Here we are, maybe half a year or year past the bottom, and you're already starting to see the market start to surge forward again.
Thornburg is a founder of the forecasting firm Beacon Economics, and he was one of the earliest predictors of the housing meltdown. Now he's shaking his head again at what's going on in California.
Think about the last couple of real estate cycles we saw in California, late 70s, late 80s. In both those circumstances, the markets took 3 or 4 years before we started to see a substantial bounce in the market.
Not this time. Home prices in this state are up 10% from a year ago, according to figures out this week from the research firm DataQuick. At almost all levels of the housing market, there is now competition. Time for Kelly to finish her sentence.
You get your hopes up, and then it's disappointing.
Same for her husband, Andy.
At first it was kind of exciting, but then it just got old.
And we thought it would be easy because there were so many houses for sale. And that's what everybody thinks. But every house we put an offer on, there were so many offers.
real estate bidding wars are back. Not to the point where buyers are literally throwing ever higher checks at sellers like they did 5 years ago. But in the state of California, 55% of all home sales last year were the result of multiple bids. The average number of bids on each home sale? 5, according to the California Association of Realtors. Steve Goddard is their president.
People are seeing that the values are going up and they want to jump on the bandwagon again.
All well and good, right? I mean, we hear that there are a gazillion homes out there with low prices. Buyer's market. So what's with the bidding wars?
You might think to yourself, well, gee, this seems almost paradoxical. What's driving the show?
Chris Thornburg.
The answer is government policy. The housing markets are being driven really by 4 things. Low interest rates, FHA lending, the Hope for Homeowners program, and, of course, last but not least, this tax credit.
That would be the first-time home buyer's tax credit, up to $8,000 to subsidize the purchase of a new home.
Those all conspired to create a frenzy in the market, in part by boosting demand artificially, and in part by constraining supply artificially.
The constrained supply part of that equation, according to Thornburg, is that many lenders are taking their time putting foreclosed homes back on the market. And the government's rescue programs are keeping people in homes that they're never really going to be able to afford. So all that troubled housing stock that's supposedly waiting to be snapped up, not on the market. And that means fewer properties out there for buyers to fall in love with.
The ceilings were popcorn, so we just finished scraping those. So you can see why we want to get it out of here.
And that's where we return to Kelly and Andy and their hard-earned fixer-upper. They paid $285,000 for it, $10,000 over the asking price, with an FHA-backed 30-year mortgage. When we say hard-earned, we mean hard-earned. Throughout 2008 and much of 2009, they looked and they looked and they looked.
If someone had told me that it was going to take me a year, I would have went, oh, forget it. But we kept going.
We viewed over 200 homes.
Did you catch that? 200 homes. Don Gephardt is the Frombach's realtor.
And in that process, we made over 50 offers. People's perception of what's going on isn't really what's going on. You're dealing with first-time home buyers, FHA, that are coming in with 3.5% down. You're dealing with move-up buyers. You're dealing with investors who are coming in with cash. So everybody's in the marketplace for this time.
In the end, Kelly and Andy had to lower their expectations of what they could get for their money, a realization familiar to anyone who bought at the height of the real estate boom. They estimate they'll sink about $18,000 into their remodel, putting the house some $30,000 above its initial asking price. And worth every penny, says Kelly.
It's nice to own a little place in the world, like it be your own, and we could do whatever we want to it. You know, it's ours. It's comforting.
At least they're not calling their home an investment. We have photos of the Frombachs and their home at marketplace.org. While you're there, tell us about your experiences in the housing market recently, or share your thoughts on bidding wars. Well, we're kind of a version of those multiple offer homes. We usually deal with multiple questions in this segment of the show, but this week we're going to try something a little different. We're going to take one listener with a lot of questions and help her go in a new direction with her finances. Here to do that with me this week is MSM personal finance columnist Liz Pulliam-Weston. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Tess.
We hear from so many people who have a lot going on in their financial lives. They don't know where to go, what to do next, and especially young people who are starting out their careers. Do you hear from them a lot?
Oh, yeah. And it's so complicated a lot of times. They're trying to deal with paying off debt, dealing with student loans, trying to start their lives. You know, how much do I spend on this? Can I buy a house? There's so many questions that are posed. And they are at a stage in life where they feel like they should be getting going. But these days, it's pretty hard to do that.
Absolutely. And, you know, things just not coming together. They don't know whether they're doing things wrong or right, which I think is the case no matter what your age. But we heard from one of our listeners recently, and she is really in this situation. She's 26 years old. And let's take a listen to what she told us about her financial life.
My name is Christine, and I live in Boise, Idaho. I would describe my financial situation as very complicated. I was working with the Idaho State Historical Society as an assistant curator. In 2008, the state made massive budget cuts, and my job was affected. I studied history. That was my passion. It still is. And I kept trying to look for other jobs, obviously, but there were none available in that field. Things got pretty dire. I lost my apartment. I was close to losing my car, too. I wound up living with my parents. I felt pretty depressed. I was going to the unemployment office every day. I interviewed with the Peace Corps. I considered joining the military. I wanted some stability. Then I took a job that I really just took out of necessity. I work in a human resources office for a corporation. I've taken a huge pay cut. Eventually got back on my feet, moved back on my own. Something very humble, but I was pretty just content. I'm making my bills every month, and I'm paying off my school loans, $300 a month. And the car is almost paid off, something like $800 left on the car. The credit card's almost done, but down to about $1,000 now. But I'm paying slightly more than a minimum, and it's not leaving me very much at the end of the month. After rent and utilities and all that, I still have to be very, I want to say frugal, but I don't know if that's like appropriate or not, because it actually feels a little bit cheaper than that. I got to see Where the Wild Things Are for $2 last night. I feel pretty good about that. A couple months late, but in a theater, legally. I've been sacrificing a lot of other things that I could have saved for just paying off these bills. They have total control, where I feel like I'm not gaining anything. I'm just making it through.
Well, first of all, Liz, I don't know about you, but my first reaction is, first of all, she's only 26. The fact that she doesn't have her dream job in her mid-20s yet certainly shouldn't make her feel bad about anything. I think a lot of folks, you know, they don't get to exactly where they want to be in life right away.
Particularly with the recession, I think a lot of people starting out of college might have started getting some traction and then lost it. And that is a blow. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're 26, probably worse if you're 46.
Sure.
It's awful if you're 56. But at 26, she does have a lot of time to recover. And I loved what she said about, you know, being cheaper than frugal. Because frankly, if you live cheap in your 20s, you're going to set yourself up for so much better a life as time goes on. One of the best pieces of advice I ever heard for college students was continue to live like a broke college student for a few years afterwards until you get used to making money and putting things aside for retirement and doing all that other great stuff. Because the impulse is to run out and get a great apartment and buy a new wardrobe and get that car. And
I wish I had heard that advice.
Yes.
When I left college.
Just a few more years of ramen, I swear,
right,
it's going to be better.
Right, because this story certainly was familiar to me.
The only thing that comes to mind is that if she's finding it hard to pay only a little above the minimums on those credit cards, probably her basic expenses are too high. Maybe she moved out a little too quick. Maybe her apartment's a little too expensive. Could be she just signed up for a little bit more in terms of basic expenses than she can really cover right now.
Well, shall we get Christine on the phone and give her a few solid financial goals?
Yeah.
Hello.
Hey, Christine. It's Tess and Liz at Marketplace Money.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Just fine, thanks.
Well, Liz Pulliam-Weston and I have been going over some of your questions and your concerns. And I think, first of all, we want to say congratulations.
For what?
Well, you've got started on a few good points, right, Liz?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look at this. She's got the car down to just $800. She's got the credit card debt down to $1,000. Mm-hmm. I know there's a bunch of her peers who would like to be in that
absolutely.
Position.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And I'm so glad that you finally got to see Where the Wild Things Are. And for $2, no less.
And for $2, no less, too. Yeah, exactly. Not on IMAX, but, you know, it was still the full movie experience, too.
There you go.
And you get free popcorn. So, like,
free popcorn?
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, so I really don't see what people are thinking, paying $18 or whatever it is. You just have to wait a couple months, that's all. So,
right.
Anyway, well, thank you, ladies. I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, we did want to talk to you a little bit about your concerns for the future. And, you know, Liz and I certainly understand that you're not in your dream job now, but I think we definitely want to express that it's not the end of the line.
No, I know. You're right. Absolutely. It feels so interminable.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know where this is going, and I feel like college was just a joke. I don't even know if I'll be using my major. You know, it's hard. It's just hard to kind of accept that.
Yeah, Liz, I don't think she has to accept that.
No, I really don't. A lot of people have these cul-de-sacs in their careers where you think, I'm going to be in this cubicle for the rest of my born days.
Right.
It does not have to be like that. I mean, we are pretty much, I believe, at the nadir of an economic cycle. I think things are going to get better. I think it's going to take a while. And I don't know that particular job will come back, but something like it.
And for the record, too, I am very happy that I am employed and have been for the last year. Like, I'm not even complaining on that, in all seriousness.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's really hard. Yeah. How'd you get into history?
How did I get into history? It was something that I wanted to study since I was in grade school. I guess when I was about 15 or 16, I spent a summer with my family in New York, and I got to see, you know, all of the great museums, Natural History Museum, all that. And it decided, I went back to my family and I said, I want to study art history. And didn't really go over too well.
Why not?
Well, because they didn't really know what to say to that. They just saw this whole life of school and debt.
So they saw the future.
They totally predicted it and called it on the spot. And so now I'm kind of thinking, was this a bad idea? Like, is this really just not viable for my life?
Oh, wow.
I'm really reconsidering. So I want to be open.
Well, first of all, I think you can't say it was all for naught, because your first job, you actually got into the field that you wanted to get into. Then, you know, you became victim to what so many millions of Americans became victim to, which is a recession.
Mm-hmm.
And these come around.
Well, Christine, let me ask you. I mean, I totally agree, but let's find out what debt load you're looking at. Did you get an advanced degree or just the bachelor's?
No, just a BA.
Okay, and how much debt did you wind up with total?
I think now I'm at $25,000.
And are those all federal student loans?
Yes.
Okay. Federal student loans, basically best student loan debt you can get. It is flexible. It's relatively low rate. It's usually tax deductible. And are those loans consolidated? Do you have a fixed rate?
No.
Get those loans consolidated. Pay the minimum. You really do not need to be in a big rush to pay off those loans, because it's such easy, flexible debt.
Okay.
And then you can tackle the other debt in your life and start feeling like you're making some progress, because I think that's what you're longing for, right? It's just some forward motion in your life.
Exactly. It's stalled.
You know what? If you consolidate those federal student loans and start throwing that extra money at that credit card debt, you'll get it paid off in a few months and you'll be done.
And do I need to begin to save? Like, do I need to focus on a savings account right now?
Not yet.
Okay.
I wouldn't you agree, Liz?
Yeah.
I mean, get rid of that credit card debt.
Get rid of the credit card debt. You're so close to being done. Get over that hump.
Okay.
Try to put $500, $1,000 into a savings account, you know, emergency savings.
Okay.
And then start thinking about, you know, funding a retirement account. Do they have that at your job? Like a 401k?
All that, 401k.
With a match?
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't even addressed it yet. I've still just tried to, like, focus on the present, you know, but yeah, that's all available.
The unfortunate thing is the years fly by much faster than you can imagine.
Yes.
So as soon as you can, you know, sign up for that 401k, start putting a little, even if it's just a fraction, you know, like 1 or 2% of your salary.
All right.
Just get started. It's amazing once you get started how easy it is to keep going.
Good. Okay. So I'm headed in the right direction.
You are.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And one thing a book that really helped me when I was casting around when I was about your age was What Color Is Your Parachute?
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I'll tell you what, you do the exercises in those books, you get clear about what your passion is, and you're pretty clear already.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how things start falling into place once you know where you want to be.
I know my parents read that.
Mm-hmm. It's in every library, so you don't have to go spend any money.
I'm sure it's on my parents' bookshelf.
There you go.
I'm not kidding. I remember that. It's making me smile. Yeah.
Well, good. I'm glad we made you smile.
Yes.
All is not lost. It, you know, again, the economy will recover. You'll rebound. Just keep paying off what you can pay off. You'll get that down.
This is good. I've taken notes.
Christine, you really are doing great. You are headed in the right direction. I know it can feel like you're at the bottom of a well, but
you
are climbing
out.
And you're
also far from alone. There are so many people your age and other ages who are in the same boat asking the same questions. So you're not alone, but you actually have taken a really positive step toward figuring it all out.
Talking to you guys? Definitely. This is actually a breath of fresh air. Thank you.
Good luck, Christine.
Have a good day.
Bye, Christine.
Bye-bye.
We are here to take all of your questions. Do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can always write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz, thanks again for the great advice.
Thank you, Tess.
And remember to check with your own financial planner before you make any big money decisions. Foreclosure auctions are hot events right now, but only a few bidders find out about the best deals. Is it insider trading?
Here's the thing. The data is public for everybody. You just have to know where to get it.
That's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm sure you have a copy of Strunk and White's The Elements of Style from college sitting around somewhere. Simple rules for elegant writing. Well, economics professors Burton Malkiel and Charles Ellis recently released an homage to the classic called, of course, Elements of Investing. I asked Burton Malkiel to tell us about the 122-page book, including why shorter is better in investing advice.
I've got a 400-page book on investing that's got these lessons. Charlie Ellis, my co-author, has a 400-page book. For most people, they look at something that large and just throw up their hands and say, you know, I don't want to spend many hours reading through all of that. And what we've tried to do is tell individuals really everything they need to know in essentially a 100-page book. We also told the publisher we wanted to make this easy to read, so use a big typeface. And what we've tried to do is tell individuals really everything they need to know and that they can grasp in maybe an hour or two of reading.
Fair enough. You know, the one sentence takeaway from The Elements of Style is make every word tell. And I wonder how you would phrase that for your book, perhaps make every dollar count?
I think that's probably a very good way of doing it. First of all, make sure you've got some dollars to begin with. In other words, it all starts with saving.
Which sounds so basic. And I wonder your thoughts on why we still need to tell people that this is important.
Well, I think because saving requires discipline. It's incredible to me how much stuff we accumulate. Talk to any 25-year-old. Say, you spent so-and-so many dollars. Did you really get satisfaction? Hmm. And I'll bet you the answer invariably is, I got a lot of stuff that I really didn't need. We're trying to get people to think in terms of what they give up in a dollar that they don't save is not just a dollar later in life, but maybe $20 or $30 because, as Albert Einstein once said, the power of compounding is probably the strongest force in the universe.
Let's talk about those dollars that people are putting away once they start doing that. You are all about indexing. And you are particularly talking about total market indexing. And that means that we're not just talking about the S&P. Is that a change from even just a few years ago where it did seem like the conventional wisdom was, okay, put some of your money in the S&P 500 and maybe half of it in bonds and you'll be good?
I think it is. And it's actually been a change in my thinking. As first of all, I realized that the S&P 500 is only large companies. Maybe some of the faster growing companies are the smaller ones. So maybe we ought to go from an S&P 500 to a total U.S. stock market fund, and then realizing that, in fact, you think of everything we buy and you realize it is a global economy. There are wonderful global companies, and what we ought to do is completely diversify, and that's what we think people should invest in for the long pull.
You write that this book includes a lifetime of lessons that you wish you'd always known. I wonder if you'd be willing to share with us a lesson that perhaps you learned the hard way.
When I was in my 20s, first of all, there were no index funds then, so I didn't even know that I could have done something like this. But I bought a lot of individual stocks. A few of them did well. A number of them were disasters. So I learned that lesson that trying to time the market was wrong. Nobody can do it. But I've also learned if you buy the thing that's popular, that everybody thinks is wonderful, you are likely to make terrible mistakes. And we know from statistics that that's what people do.
I just want to, in closing, bring this back around to the elements of style. And it does seem like the rules of language are pretty timeless. But with investing, you have things like tax laws, all kinds of new financial products that come along. You mentioned that there weren't index funds in your early years of investing. So is it really possible to write a classic investing manual?
I do think so. The lesson of diversification, the lesson that you ought to have not just stocks, but stocks and bonds, the fact that you shouldn't put all your money in the stock of the company that you work for. Those are timeless.
Burton Malkiel is the co-author with Charles Ellis of The Elements of Investing, and we've been talking about the book. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This past Tuesday, the day before St. Paddy's Day, Ireland's finance minister went to Brussels to address the massive national debt facing the Emerald Isle and others in the Eurozone. In Ireland's case, part of the problem was a runaway housing boom. Christopher Wirth reports on how the muzzling of the Celtic Tiger is affecting young Irish homeowners.
It's tea time at the home of Geraldine and Paul Mangan Ebbs. Like many young Irish couples, they're just starting their life together and trying to make a go of it. Paul is 31 and works in construction. After a hard week, he likes to catch the rugby game on TV at the weekend.
Ireland have support there. And it's now a tall O'Connell who gets hit.
Geraldine is 29 and works as a civil servant. She and Paul got married last year, and they'd like to start a family. But those plans are on hold. Like many here, they've taken big pay cuts over the last year, and they're saddled with a three-bedroom house they can no longer afford.
This is the office, come spare bedroom. This year, everything is nearly there, you know?
They like the house well enough, but it's in the middle of nowhere, more than an hour's drive from their jobs in Dublin and all their friends and family. So every Monday morning, dogs in tow, they pack up and head to Geraldine's dad's place in the city for the week. Geraldine says when they bought their house back in 2004, they were desperate to get a foot on the property ladder. They paid about $300,000. Today, it might be worth $200,000. That is, if there were any buyers.
This was always supposed to be our first time house. It was always with the view of moving on, you know, and that's just, I don't know if that'll happen now, you know.
Geraldine and Paul are part of what some in Ireland might call the new lost generation. It's made up mostly of young couples who splurged on their first house during the boom and now face years of daunting negative equity and the prospect of a sluggish economy for a long time to come. 29-year-old Liam Delaney might count himself among them. He teaches economics at University College Dublin. His salary took a big hit in the recent round of budget cuts.
You know, we were living during a bubble, and we knew nothing other than continuous economic growth, and we're seeing for the first time that that's not inevitable.
In fact, much of that growth was based on borrowing in a country that really hadn't been a big borrower before. Personal debt just about tripled during the years of the Celtic Tiger, when easy loans and 100% mortgages were pushed in commercials like this one.
If you're a first-time buyer, Bank of Ireland now offer 100% mortgages with your deposit up front. For information,
throw in a newfound access to credit cards, and you had a recipe for disaster. Looking back now, Geraldine Mangan Ebb says Ireland just got carried away with itself.
I think we got very greedy in this country. Just spending, spending, spending. People are just going crazy spending because they never had it before. I'm like, oh, all of a sudden, oh my God, look what I have. Wow, I can get anything, you know?
Geraldine and Paul didn't just sign up for a pricey mortgage. They also borrowed to buy a new car and took out a loan to pay for their wedding.
We're still paying for that as well. I mean, our first year of marriage has probably been the most stressful that we've been together because of the financial stress.
Now, as they struggle to pay their bills, they're also stressing over the future of Paul's construction job. The latest estimates show that Ireland built around 350,000 more houses than it needs. With that kind of surplus, Paul doesn't expect to see much construction work going on over the next few years. So he's back in school, studying part-time for a degree in construction management. He says this will give him the credentials he needs if he decides to look for work somewhere else.
Anyone graduating out of college who's going to leave Ireland now? I know people from school who are graduating this year. Maybe 90% of the class is leaving Ireland to get work.
And that's raised fears that this lost generation of young people really will be lost to places like Canada, Australia, and the United States. Paul knows life was much tougher for earlier generations who faced famine and destitution in Ireland. But, he says, at least they weren't weighed down with so much debt and houses that no one wanted to buy. They, at least, were free to leave. In Dublin, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace Money.
So we've talked now about housing issues in California and in Ireland. Well, how about Phoenix, where more than 4,000 homes are sold at auction each month? Investors buy foreclosed properties at basement prices, and then they flip them. But if you want to get in on that game, caveat emptor. From KJZZ, Peter O'Dowd reports.
Every weekday on the steps of the Maricopa County Courthouse, experienced investors gather around fast-talking auctioneers.
BFAR Resolution Network here, Fidelity 090-1371-3, report to be located at 71071 St. Charles Avenue.
If you're new to the world of foreclosure auctions, here are a couple of things you need to know. Banks hire a trustee to manage the sale of delinquent property. In Arizona, that trustee must publicly publish an opening bid on each property the morning before the auction. That means you, me, or an investor, like this guy,
Patrick Bush,
can research the house ahead of time and decide just how much we're willing to bid. And if you're really good at this, you'll have a tip sheet that shows how much is owed on the property and whether the sale will be bogged down with a second mortgage. But even a professional investor can find himself at a disadvantage at these courthouse auctions because something fishy's been happening lately. Some trustees slash their asking price within hours of the auction.
It gives the appearance of impropriety.
Tom Ruff spends his workday tracking housing data, looking for these so-called drop bids. As an example of how drop bids benefit a professional investor, he pulls up a four-bedroom house on his computer. The property's opening sale price was around $174,000, but sometime before the auction,
the bid was dropped from $174,907 to $55,000.
Okay, that might sound like an irresistible deal, but there's no way that you, the casual buyer, will ever know about it. Even professional investors wouldn't have a clue unless they got the inside scoop, which is probably why only one person was around to bid on that $55,000 house in the first place. Ruff says that investor, by the way, flipped the house a month later and made an $80,000 profit.
When you're looking for impropriety, always follow the money. And there's a lot of money in foreclosures right now.
Since June, Ruff has counted 1,200 drop bids in Arizona. If you want to get the inside track on those deals, it helps to know a guy like Brad Kelly. His company constantly compiles data for clients who make a living at these auctions. The moment he sees a drop bid, Kelly can send an email blast to those investors.
Here's the thing. The data is public for everybody. You just have to know where to get it. You know, if somebody wants to call that unfair, well, I guess they could call that unfair, but we don't think it is.
Whether these bids are unfair is up for debate. But why are they happening in the first place? Tom Ruff says almost all the drop bids in Arizona come from California trustees. Ward Hannigan is a former California investor who now trains people to buy distressed property at auction. He says drop bids started showing up there a few years ago.
But only sporadically. Now it's like crazy.
When I asked Hannigan why, he echoed the concern many others share, that big trustees are working sweetheart deals with the information. But Rand Johnson says that's just untrue. He's the president of the United Trustees Association in California, and he says there's nothing devious about drop bids at all.
There's just sheer volume. You know, we're dealing with not a few hundred foreclosures. We're doing thousands of foreclosures. Things are changing fairly quick out there.
Johnson says banks are working right up into the final moments of the auction. Loans get modified, people file for bankruptcy, sale prices need to be adjusted, and all that's hard to do in a timely fashion as the banks scramble to clear their books of millions of delinquent properties.
If you're not signed in, you cannot bid with us.
But what if those time management problems trickle down to you, the casual buyer? In this market, it's not uncommon to see investors like Christine and John Augustine gathered in front of the county courthouse. They've never been to an auction.
We'll either come back one property richer or wiser. So, probably the wiser.
There's probably inside information. There's probably a lot of, if you know what you're doing, it's a little easier to get it done.
Christine Augustine says that if an investor here knows something she doesn't about the property she wants, she's simply outgunned. And since she's never heard of drop bids, chances are she's already at a disadvantage. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace Money.
So you filled out your NCAA college hoops brackets last weekend, sure in the knowledge that Murray State would never beat Vandy and the Fighting Irish would have no trouble handling Old Dominion. Oops. Well, if basketball isn't quite doing it for you, here's another way to go about bracketology. Rank how much it costs to go to any of the schools in the tournament. Abe Sauer of the website The All has done just that.
I did some research on tuitions for all the different schools that were originally seeded by the NCAA and then ran the brackets based on those schools' tuition.
So how'd your bracket turn out? Who were the winners and perhaps, I guess, the losers?
Well, a school that I actually had to look up named Lehigh. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Yes, you are.
That's in Pennsylvania. Wake Forest, Richmond, and Vanderbilt were the final four. All of them coming in above $38,000 a year. The losers, depending on how you look at it, might be the ones paying the $40,000 a year to attend Richmond.
Right. Any Cinderella in here?
Not really. I guess the Cinderellas would be the schools charging less than $10,000 a year that made it into the third round. UC Santa Barbara and North Texas came in. North Texas was $7,000. UC Santa Barbara was just over $9,000.
So how does all this compare with what the sports world is actually predicting?
I don't think it's very close. It's probably not going to look anything like my bracket.
Well, obviously, there's some kind of social commentary in here. What are you trying to say?
The interest is just looking at the discrepancies between schools that are all involved in the same athletic tournament and how wildly different they actually are in tuition. You know, I have to question if school like Marquette at $29,000 and a school like Brigham Young at, you know, just over $4,000. I mean, is there really a $25,000 per year premium difference on the education you get there? I don't know.
Where'd you go to school?
The UW-Wisconsin-Madison.
Ah, so we are Big Ten rivals then.
Oh, really? Where did you go to school?
I went to Northwestern, where sports was not a factor.
I was about to say, yeah, is Northwestern this year?
I don't even know.
I just wanted to hear you say no.
Okay, no. And how's Madison going to do this year?
I hope they make it to at least, you know, it'd be nice to see them in the Final Four. I don't think I would pick my money bracket with them in the Final Four because I want to win.
Okay. Abe Sauer, appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you very much.
And that's money, Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, would you hire this guy to help you fight foreclosure?
No way am I an expert. Of course not. I'm just crazy.
Crazy like a fox when it comes to tangling with the banks. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.